So Bitcoin is often thought to be secure as long as 51% of the mining power is honest. But this assumes that all parties see all valid blocks and transactions. Bitcoin relies on its peer-to-peer network to deliver this information. So if you control the peer-to-peer network, you can control the flow of information within Bitcoin and thereby control the blockchain. In this talk, we're going to attack the peer-to-peer network and use information eclipsing to subvert Bitcoin security. So first I'm going to tell you what an eclipse attack is and the bad things you can do with an eclipse attack. Then I'm going to show you how you can perform an eclipse attack, how you can get into position to perform an eclipse attack on the peer-to-peer network, and how many and the resources necessary to do this. And then finally, I'll discuss our countermeasures and their deployment in the Bitcoin ecosystem. So before I tell you what an eclipse attack is, I have to explain a little bit about the Bitcoin's peer-to-peer network. So these are nodes in the peer-to-peer network, and we're going to be looking at the purple node. And by default, nodes make 8 outgoing TCP connections. The direction of the arrow is the direction of the TCP connection. And there are nodes allow up to 117 incoming TCP connections. These connections, these edges, are used to gossip transactions and blocks, where blocks are a special type of aggregation of transactions. And for blocks, I'm using this blue square icon. And so you can see that someone discovers a block, and they spread it through the network, and the blocks flow across these edges, and they can flow in both directions. So our attack is only going to look at nodes that accept incoming connections. Not all nodes accept incoming connections. Some wallets, some nodes behind NATs do not accept incoming connections. So what is an eclipse attack? Well, in information eclipsing, if you manage to gain control over a peer-to-peer, over a node in a peer-to-peer's network's access to information, you have eclipsed it. So for example, if the purple nodes, all of their connections were to attackers that sort of conspired against it, they could deny, they could prevent it from learning about that block being sent around, and they could also tell it things which it couldn't tell any other part of the network. And so normally attackers are not in this position. So what I'm going to talk about later is how attackers can get into this position. But before I do that, I want to explain why this is so bad to once a node has been eclipsed. And we can redraw that picture so the attacker is sitting in the middle between the purple node and the rest of the network. But this doesn't mean the attacker is an on-path attacker. It just means that all of the purple node's connections are to the attacker, so the attacker can decide what the purple node sees. So what bad things can you do if you eclipse a node? Well, you can perform a 51% attack with less than 50% of the mining power. So in this case, we have an attacker that is 40% of the mining power. We have the purple node is also a miner with 30%. And the rest of the network has 30%. The rest of the network is drawn by this cloud. And we're going to represent each party's view of the blockchain up here. The attack hasn't started yet, so they all see the blue block. The first thing the attacker does is it partitions the network so that the two other parties can't build on each other's blocks. The attacker can then outcompete each miner individually. So because the attacker is 40% of the mining power, it'll generate a longer blockchain than the purple node. Bitcoin always uses the longest blockchain, and it can perform the same attack against the rest of the network. So the attacker's blockchain will become the consensus chain. This is equivalent to a 51% attack because the attacker can ensure only the attacker's blocks are added to the blockchain. So the attacker could choose not to include any transactions in the blockchain and Bitcoin would just stop working, or the attacker could use this to go undo history in the blockchain and lots of other bad things. Now in this attack, we assume the attacker not only had eclipsing power but also had mining power. There are some other attacks that can be improved with mining power. For example, we can do an improved selfish mining attack, but I'm not going to talk about that here. So now let's look at a situation in which the attacker does not have any mining power. And we've added a merchant to this picture. And the merchant and the purple miner are going to share the same view of the blockchain. Now the attacker wants to do a double spend. So yes, the purple node has 30% of the mining power, the rest of the network has 70%. So the attacker double spends a transaction. This transaction gives coin zero to the merchant, and then there's a separate double spend transaction that gives coin zero back to the attacker. The attacker has partitioned the network, and because both the miner and the merchant see the same thing, the miner includes this transaction in a block and then confirms it and mines blocks on top of that. And the same thing happens with the rest of the network. The rest of the network sees the transaction, includes it, and starts building blocks. But neither side knows that the other blockchain exists. So the merchant has no idea that the transaction's been double spent due to the partition, and the merchant has no idea that there is an existing longer blockchain. So the merchant releases its goods to the attacker. And then the attacker starts relaying blocks again, and all of a sudden this blockchain is no longer valid. It's thrown away. The transaction to the merchant is thrown away, and the attacker gets the money back. So the merchant thought they saw a transaction. The merchant, in fact, did see a transaction confirmed in this example by three blocks. So the merchant thought it was safe, but because of the eclipsing, the merchant was unaware that it was unsafe, and the attacker was able to perform double spending. So this attack this attacker didn't have any mining power. It co-opted a third party's mining power. And in our paper, we have some other no mining power eclipsing attacks. So now I'm going to explain how you get in this position to perform this attack. So normally an attacker that joins the network to attack the purple node is not necessarily going to be connected to by the purple node. So the attacker needs to manipulate the purple node such that the purple node will make outgoing connections to it. So the attacker fills the purple node's peer tables with attacker IPs, and I'll explain how peer tables work in the next slide. The node then restarts and loses its outgoing connections. And then when the node goes to draw on its peer tables to make new connections, because they've been filled with attacker IPs, it will connect to the attacker. So how do these peer tables work? Well, each node picks its peers from two tables. The new table stores IPs that the peer is has heard about but not connected to, and the tried table has IPs that the node has peered with at some point in the past but may not be a current peer. These tables contain buckets, and inside the buckets there are IP addresses. We represent honest IPs by the green circle. The tables also store a timestamp for each IP. I won't go into how timestamps work for the new table because it's not important to our attack, but in the tried table, the timestamp is the last time that node connected to our node, so the last time this IP address connected to the node. So if a node wants to make an outgoing connection, it's going to use these IPs. The first thing it decides is whether it's going to choose from the new or tried table. Once it's selected a table, it selects an IP address from in the table. This selection is biased towards fresher, more recent timestamps, and then it attempts an outgoing connection to that IP address. So what the attacker wants to do is just fill these tables up with attacker IPs represented by the red circles, so that when it goes to choose an IP address, it has no choice but to choose attacker IPs. Furthermore, the attacker can tilt the game in their favor by ensuring that their IPs are always the freshest IPs. So how does the attacker actually get IPs into these tables? Well, whenever a node makes a connection to another node, it gets its IP in the tried table of that node. Furthermore, once a connection's been established, a node can announce additional IPs, and those go in the new table. Now, I drew it with four dots, but you could imagine this with, in actual practice, these messages can contain up to 1,000 IPs, and you can send multiple messages. So filling the new table is trivial, and we won't talk about it in this attack. It's much harder to fill the tried table, and so that's what that's what we're going to focus on. And then the attacker can just repeat this, and for each node under its control, for each IP address that it controls, it gets an additional IP into the tried table. And then the attacker waits for the node to restart. Once the node has restarted, when it goes to select new outgoing connections, because it's filled the tried and new table, these connections will be to attacker IPs. And so the attacker has eclipsed all outgoing connections. But remember that I said these nodes also have incoming connections. So how do we do this? Well, it's actually really simple. You can make 117 connections from the same IP. So you can just fill up all the incoming connection slots on a node and eclipse it. So how easy are these restarts? Is it practical? How can this happen? The attacker needs these restarts. Well, we all know there's like a day of the week in which you patch your computer. So attackers could plan around that, or could wait for that to happen. Also, there's critical security vulnerabilities that are released that the victim either needs to patch or it's lose-lose for the victim. There's been several denial of service and packets of death CVEs in Bitcoin and many more in underlying OSs. And one study said that within about 10 hours, a public Bitcoin node has about a 25% chance of going offline. And then finally, the security of Bitcoin's peer-to-peer network should not rely on 100% node uptime. So the attack isn't as easy as just filling the tried table. There's one complicating detail, and it's the reason for these buckets. So an IP address is going to be sent to tried. And what Bitcoin does is it breaks the IP address into two pieces. The first part is called the group. It's the /16 prefix of the IP. And the second part is just the second part of the IP. We hash the group to four buckets, so it chooses four buckets. And then the second part of the IP chooses one of those buckets for the address to be placed in. Now, this actually makes the attack more difficult. Imagine you have a whole bunch of contiguous IP addresses. Many of them, if they're within the same group, which they're likely to be unless it's an enormous amount of contiguous IP addresses, they'll be within the same /16, you're only going to be able to fill those four buckets. So this either requires massive numbers of IP addresses, or it requires that you have a botnet that has sufficient IP diversity. In our paper, we consider both scenarios, but in this we're just going to look at. But in this talk, we're just going to look at botnets. So what do? You're an attacker. You have a limited number of IP addresses. The more IP addresses you have, the better off it is. The more IP addresses in distinct groups, the fewer IP address honest IPs in the tried table, the better as well, because you have less to compete with. And we've already showed that you have this selection bias that you can exploit to get more bang for your buck for your IPs. But also notice that the selection bias, if you make the honest IPs more stale, it helps you as well. And so what you can do is you can just run the attack for longer. If the honest IPs all have timestamps from 1 hour ago and you run the attack for 5 hours, now they're 6 hours stale. So you basically have two resources, the number of IP addresses you have and the time invested in the attack. So it actually gets worse. There's some other things the attacker can exploit. So these buckets only hold 64 IP addresses. So if we have a bucket that's full that has 64 IP addresses in it, and a new IP is going to be hashed to that bucket, it needs to evict something. And so the Bitcoin eviction routine is to randomly select four IPs, to delete the oldest IP, and then to insert the new IP in its place. This gives the attacker two additional vulnerabilities. Because this selection process is random, the attacker, if the attacker evicts one of their own IP addresses, they can just rerun that IP address and potentially evict an honest one. So they can just improve their chances by trying over and over again. Additionally, as we've already discussed, the attacker can ensure they're the most fresh. So if one of the four is an honest IP, the attacker can basically ensure that the honest IP will be evicted. So we've explained how to do this, but who can do this? How easy is this to do? So our approach was to look at the Bitcoin source code and model it with probability analysis, and then also use Monte Carlo simulations to validate this, to validate our probability analysis. We use these models to determine effective attack parameters, time invested, number of distinct IPs, and then we experimentally verified these parameters against live Bitcoin nodes. We did these to our own Bitcoin nodes, but they were part of the Bitcoin network. So we ran several experiments, but the but I'm only going to tell you about two. The first experiment was a worst case experiment. So we wanted to see how an attacker could win like all the time, no matter what was in the tried table. So we artificially filled the node's tried table with honest IPs, and these had the freshest timestamps of just before the attack. Our model predicted we needed about 4,800 IPs with two IPs per group and about 5 hours invested in the attack. After the attack, the node's tried table was almost completely filled with attacker IPs. And we performed this experiment 50 times, and in each time, the attacker was able to eclipse all 8 outgoing connections for 100% success rate. And this is, you know, when we look at botnet sizes, this is clearly a pretty small botnet. Botnets have both the diversity and numbers far in excess of this. So the second experiment we ran was we wanted to see, well, like, how would this work against a realistic non-worst case node? So we had some Bitcoin nodes, we connected them to the network for about 43 plus days. The node that we're gonna look at had a tried table of around 300 honest IPs, so it was not full at all. And so based on this, we determined a botnet of around 400 IPs should be sufficient, investing 1 hour. And while the tried table was still empty at the attack, after the attack, a majority of the IPs were attacker IPs. And we got a 84% success rate. So ran the experiment 50 times, and each time all 8 outgoing connections were eclipsed. And we looked at the Karna botnet because its IPs have been published. And if you were to randomly sample 1,250 IPs from the Karna, you would get the group diversity on average. So just shrink a subset of Karna and you'd have enough groups to perform this attack. So we developed some countermeasures. The first countermeasure we came up with thinks about this vulnerability. We have a vulnerability towards selecting fresher timestamps. So if we just randomize the selection process, that vulnerability goes away. An additional vulnerability we face is this is eviction bias, where the oldest IP addresses are evicted. And then we also have this additional vulnerability of try again, in which you can improve your chances by just, if you evict yourself, you can run it again and then hope not to evict yourself and continually improve your chances. And what this looks like, we graph this, and so the y-axis is number of IPs that the attacker gets in the tried table, how full the attacker gets the tried table. This line here is the tried table being completely full. And so you can see it's actually fairly linear. For about 4,000 IP addresses, you get nearly 4,000 IP addresses in the tried table. So we propose a countermeasure of deterministic random eviction, in which not only do IP addresses map to buckets, but they deterministically map to positions within those buckets, evicting whatever happens to be in that position. This removes both of those vulnerabilities, and we get a much nicer line. So to get close to what under Bitcoin eviction took about 4,000 IP addresses, you'd need more than 10,000 IP addresses. An additional problem we face is that in our realistic scenario, the tried table filled up very slowly. So we have feeler connections. A feeler connection takes IPs from new, verifies that they are in fact online Bitcoin nodes, and then it adds those IPs to the tried table to fill up the tried table. Another problem is that, you know, good honest IPs are evicted from the tried table. So we have a test before evict. We test IPs in the tried table. If they're online, we don't evict them. We actually borrowed this from the Storm botnet's anti-peer poisoning system. So we told the Bitcoin developers about our attack, and they were awesome and took really quick action. They implemented countermeasures 1, 2, and 3 in Bitcoin 0.10.1, which has 30% public node deployment, right? 60% public node deployment right now, or last time I checked. But we felt that feeler and test before evict were also very important countermeasures. So we implemented these in a patch, and it's currently awaiting review. How effective are these countermeasures? Well, the countermeasures that are currently deployed, in the worst case scenario with a full tried table, raise it from about 4,600 IPs to 41,000 IPs with a attacker success rate of a coin flip. In the live node setting, they increase it by almost a factor of 10 with a lower attacker success rate. And in worst case with our patch, test before evict is really helpful, because if you have all honest, if your tried table is filled with honest IPs, then the attacker can't push any of them out, because they'll all be online. So if you're in a safe state, you tend to stay in a safe state. We analyze this in more detail, assuming churn of honest IPs in our paper. And feeler connections actually prevent us from talking about the live realistic node setting, because the tried table is going to fill up more, fill up much quicker. So it's better than this. It probably is moving this more to a worst case, but we have to perform more experiments to discuss it in detail. So one objection is that this is really bad. The peer-to-peer network is vulnerable. Maybe miners shouldn't connect to the peer-to-peer network at all and only connect to trusted parties. But how do you decide who to trust? Major mining pools have engaged in things which are less than honest behavior. And if you did create some trusted club of networks, how do you let new people in? How do you determine who to trust? And how do you prevent this from becoming like a centralized club? So our goal was to make Bitcoin robust to peer-to-peer attacks while preserving the decentralization that's at the heart of Bitcoin. So in summary, Eclipse attacks violate Bitcoin's core security guarantees. These attacks are practical. Even a very small botnet can pull them off against realistic Bitcoin nodes. And we currently have countermeasures to resist these, and some of these countermeasures are already deployed and protecting Bitcoin.
Really nice work.
Thanks.
I'm curious why Bitcoin originally decided to do this complicated buckets and tried and new versus a random selection that seems to be superior to that. What was their thinking there?
So I can't speak to their thinking, because I don't know their thinking. Looking at the code, what I imagine their thinking was that they wanted to ensure that nodes that you just recently heard about that were more likely to be online would be more likely to be chosen. But they actually really liked this countermeasure. It simplified their code base, and so they tested it and adopted it and felt that it was superior to the previous behavior.
Hi, Grady Clark, Rutgers University. I'm wondering, I have two questions. So why did the Bitcoin developers only decide to do, what is it, 1, 2, and 6, and not the try before evict? And who are the main targets of this type of attack? So are mining pools open? Because from what I understand, is, I might be wrong, they represent a single node that tries many things. So this is, these are the two questions. Thank you.
All right, let me answer your first question. The countermeasures 1, 2, and 6 were just really easy wins. They reduced the number of lines of code. They were simpler. There was less things that the attacker could use to game the system. And there was very little risk in sort of code changes. They were just making code simpler. The feeler connections and test before evict involved larger architecturing. The patch that we have is much bigger and requires much more testing. We've performed a lot of tests on it, and hopefully we can get it deployed. But that's the reason that they chose 1, 2, and 6. And they were able to bang it out amazingly quickly. The issue in terms of who would be targeted, yes, miners use gateways. And if miners relied purely on the peer-to-peer network, they would be vulnerable to these attacks. We didn't do a survey of miners to determine who was vulnerable and who was not. But you could also attack merchants with this. You could attack wallets if you were doing some sort of like local Bitcoin. Well, if you were doing some sort of Bitcoin transaction with a person, you could do this. And we know, in fact, that someone did a on-path Eclipse attack at a carnival. And they did this to make things run faster. They had a very slow uplink. And people were buying things at the carnival with Bitcoin. So they just like hijacked everyone's connection, sent it through one node, and then had that node use the slow uplink to the rest of the Bitcoin network.
Hi, Matt Kindy from Rice University. Was there any consideration of using node age in the sense of a sort of node contribution to the blockchain as consideration for including IPs inside so that relatively new users that were more likely to be attackers could be prevented from being in the tri-tables?
So if I understand your question, you're asking if we could determine nodes which have been around a long time and have contributed to Bitcoin.
Correct.
And use that as a trustworthiness.
Yes.
So I think that's a great idea. Currently in Bitcoin, nodes are not associated with blocks being produced.
Right.
But if you did have a mechanism for this, it would be very good to look at the age of someone and say, well, like this person has long-term been known as honest,
right,
a reputation system. Mm-hmm. But Bitcoin nodes don't actually have any cryptographic proof of identity, and some of them switch IP addresses quite frequently.
Right.
So it would be a little bit difficult to do with Bitcoin, but you could like layer something on top.
Thank you.